Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. There's some real estate today, a little bit of healthcare, some technology too, and also a woman who used to cook for zoo animals. Hey, somebody's got to do it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, the 23rd of June is what my calendar says. Great as always to have you with us, everybody. We started yesterday with the real estate, residential real estate, if you'll recall, home sales to be specific. Today, it's commercial real estate and the money to be made therein. Last time you ate at the Olive Garden, assuming you ever have, you probably thought more about the breadsticks than who owns the building, which is fair enough. But today, Darden Restaurants, which owns the Olive Garden, Longhorn Steakhouse, and a couple of other chains, said it's going to spin off its real estate into something called a REIT. That's an REIT, a real estate investment trust, and then lease the properties back. If that sounds like a strange circular kind of logic, well, A, it is. But also B, Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson is going to walk you through the whys and hows of it.
REITs are everywhere.
You know, REITs are real estate companies.
Michael Gruppe is with the National Association of Real Estate Investment Trusts.
If you work in an office building, for example, there's a good chance that that property is owned by a REIT. If you live in an apartment building, it may very well be owned by a REIT.
And investors tend to like REITs because they have a steady source of income, rents, and they pay lots of that income back to investors.
Investors are not willing to pay as much for the volatile restaurant business, but the real estate is far more predictable, and therefore Darden is able to raise more capital this way.
Susan Wachter is at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. She says it makes sense for Darden to take the money it raises from the REIT, pay down some debt, and then focus on its restaurant business, while letting people who know real estate focus on the properties.
It's the old Adam Smith, specialize, 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 not location, location, location.
McDonald's and Macy's are under pressure to do something similar. Sears is already doing a version of this. John Glasgow at the University of Connecticut thinks they should have done it years ago.
Probably over half the Searses that are out there would already be shut down, and that those properties would be something else much more productive. But when they kept them together, it's tempting to say, well, I own the land. It's only costing me opportunity cost. It's not costing me real cash. Let me try one more quarter.
Glasgow says the real estate can wind up subsidizing the bad decisions of the company it's tied to. But separate, each side has to stand on its own. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
There's news from the Commonwealth of Massachusetts today about poverty, how it's measured, and education. For years, the federal school meals program has been the main way that schools measure poverty, by percentage of students who qualify for those free and reduced price meals. That, in turn, determines how schools get a lot of their funding and how they're held accountable for teaching disadvantaged kids. But Massachusetts has a new way of measuring poverty, which makes its schools look a lot less poor. From the education desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Starting next school year, students in Massachusetts will be considered economically disadvantaged, not according to their school lunch status, but if their families participate in programs like food stamps, welfare, and Medicaid.
It's a lower number in general. It's about two-thirds of the number of students that we had before.
Deputy Education Commissioner Jeff Wolfson says Massachusetts had to come up with a different way of measuring poverty. It's one of 49 states that now let high-poverty districts feed all students at no charge, so families no longer need to hand in applications, which included income data, something a lot of kids were squeamish about.
Particularly with middle or high school students, because the children are embarrassed about receiving the meals.
Zoe Neuberger is a policy analyst at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. She says federal poverty programs can better determine who's poor.
They have offices full of caseworkers whose job it is to assess family income and household composition. Schools are not set up to do that.
But those programs also tend to be more strict. Michael Griffith with the Education Commission of the States says other states are adopting similar measures. He worries the new standards could miss the working poor.
They are not poor by the definition of, you know, some of these programs, but they are clearly low income and they are struggling.
The Education Department's Jeff Wolfson says Massachusetts plans to create new funding formulas so that high-poverty schools aren't shortchanged. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Traders squeaked out a win on Wall Street. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. The generally accepted figure is that about half of all healthcare dollars are spent on just 5% of patients. So we are spending a little time this week on ways to change that equation, specifically on the relationship between spending on social services and healthcare costs, because the potential savings there are huge. But as Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports now from the health desk at WHYY, finding the services that are going to simultaneously improve health and lower costs, yeah, not so easy.
Indiana Jones, he's not.
I'm a 5'7 guy from Portland, Oregon, raised in a Jewish family.
Okay, a little more Woody Allen than Harrison Ford. But like the daring archaeologist from the movies, Dr. David Labbe is after a rare and elusive prize. He wants to keep chronically ill and poor patients in Portland from landing in the hospital again and again.
These are people who have lived in some form of constant crisis, so they know how to survive in crisis. They don't know how to take care of a chronic disease. And so they come to us for help. What we think is help to them is not helpful. It doesn't work for them. It doesn't work for us. We just have to start over.
What doesn't work is prescribing meds that must be kept cool for someone who doesn't have a refrigerator. What doesn't work is pressing patients to eat better when they don't know where their next meal's coming from. But Labby thinks he's finally found a way to get that fresh start, to work with these super sick, super expensive patients.
What I've learned is, if I'm going to help somebody, I really need to know about their life, what it's like for them on a day-to-day basis. And that takes a lot of work to really understand.
That means leaving the exam room, seeing patients in their kitchens, in their living rooms. To do that, Labby and others at the insurance company Care Oregon created the Health Resilience Program. Now, health resilience specialists, effectively social workers, like Marika Shimkus, spend a chunk of their time dropping in on patients like Scott Freeland.
How old am I?
52.
I'm 52. And happy to be alive.
Finishing each other's sentences is easy for these two.
Without you, I would be lost almost sometimes.
I don't know about that.
She is really good at her job, and she'll even let me use her phone to call and make appointments at the doctor's office or something.
I mean, I want to make sure that it's clear that the credit is really you. You've let me pester you.
Marka's job is to pester Scott and her 20 other clients to help them figure out what they need to take care of themselves and to hook them up to services like housing and food, or maybe help someone get an ID, maybe make an appointment with a specialist. The program serves about 600 of the sickest and most expensive Medicaid patients in the city. For Scott, it's made a difference. He says before he met Marka, he was living hard.
I think that year I was in the hospital 17 times or something. I was doing crystal meth, the devil's dandruff. Every time I did it, I'd start throwing up blood. I've had to have transfusion before. My throat's been so raw. It's messed my eyes up too. My diabetes has. It's a crazy life that I used to lead, but I'm doing actually pretty good now.
Matched with Marika, he was in the hospital once in their first year together. The Health Resilience Program cranks out these sorts of stories. In 2.5 years, this program has put up some gaudy numbers, cutting ER and hospital visits by 35%. Labby and the team are now household names in this little corner of the healthcare world, where doctors try to administer social services to solve medical problems. The consulting firm Oliver Wyman says we could save $300 billion a year if this type of work scaled. That could mean lower costs for all of us. This is what Healthcare City of Gold looks like, where money is saved and health is better.
There's so many things we do in American healthcare because we think that they must work.
Amitabh Chandra is an economist at Harvard.
We have incredibly powerful narratives that each one of these things is going to generate billions and billions of dollars in savings. But every time we've looked, we found the answer has been a big, giant zero.
We asked Chandra to look over data from the Health Resilience Program, and he says while the program may improve health, it's impossible to say whether it's saving any money long term. But odds are these sorts of programs are unlikely to save any real money, says Dr. Ashish Jha.
There are almost no interventions that we know of that both improve health and save money. I mean, there are a couple of things that we do know. Vaccinations are probably the number one thing. Once you get beyond that, it starts getting pretty tough.
John, who's also at Harvard, says what makes this work tough is that patients each have their own costly web of issues and illnesses that can't be resolved with a one-size-fits-all solution, like a vaccine. Pinpointing the underlying social challenges can be a guessing game for doctors, where they try to tackle very deep, persistent problems like addiction, mental illness, and obesity with treatments that often don't work. These obstacles, not to mention limited evidence, help explain why there's no line of healthcare CFOs outside Labby's door.
Until we have a business case to really take this on, I think it's going to end up being a series of pet projects.
Since his great run that first year working with Marika, Scott's life has become complicated again. A few months back, he got beat up trying to protect his cousin from her husband.
He broke my jaw and broke me a couple of ribs and was in the hospital for 10 days.
Additional health complications and drinking has led to an uptick in trips to the ER. Scott says he's trying to keep things under control, and then his cell phone rings.
Hey, can I call you back? Yeah? Uh-oh. Okay.
This is Scott's cousin telling him he's bought him some beer. The cousin and Scott's uncle live next door.
They're my closest friends, you know, that I have, and I hang out with them quite a bit, watch TV, and they drink every day, like, a lot.
The hard reality of this work is that you're trying to help fix someone's life, one full of half-steps, missteps, and backslides.
They first tell me you can't have sugar, then they tell me I can't have salt. Now, it's like, you guys kind of want me to stop drinking too? It's like, I probably will never, ever stop drinking. Just trying to be realistic, you know? And sometimes you almost have to drink just to get through all your problems and stuff. I don't know.
Is this what success looks like? Progress and then relapse? How much time and money do you invest in trying to help someone like Scott? Is Scott's setback just temporary? Important questions, says Labby, that he admits are hard to answer.
Our experience has been that people we're dealing with have had really rough lives, and they're not going to recover from those lives or the effects of those lives in one moment.
The program's goal is to build stable lives. That takes time, which takes money. It's a tough enough road that it's fair to wonder if the Labbies of the world see something in this healthcare jungle that most of us can't, or if he's a deluded do-gooder lost on a never-ending quest. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Dan's story was produced for us with support from the California Endowment Health Journalism Fellowships. They are at USC Annenberg, just down the road. Coming up,
I would create pine cones covered in peanut butter with chocolate chips or whatever the bears wanted to eat.
Somebody's got to cook for them, right? You don't want hungry bears. Our series, My First Job. But first, let's us do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 24 points, about a 10%, closed at 18,144. The NASDAQ up 6 points, also a 10%, 5160. The S&P 500 basically flat, 21.24. We told you about Darden Restaurants and its plan to spin off its real estate holdings. News did not add flavor to its stock. Darden was pretty much flat. The big winner today, Green Dot, the company that makes prepaid credit cards, renewed its deal with Walmart. Green Dot charged up 40%, 40%. Walmart off 0.3%. No apparent impact, really, of its decision to stop selling Confederate flagged items. eBay, pretty much the same thing. Same decision, up 0.3% there. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.41%.
and you're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is a nonprofit, listener-supported service. To keep our coverage strong and relevant, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount counts twice thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from Newman's Own Foundation. Donate at Marketplace.org by June 30th, and thanks.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department issues its final estimate for first quarter gross domestic product. Meeting the transportation needs of rural America is the focus of a hearing of the House Transportation Committee. Also in Washington, the annual Smithsonian Folklife Festival opens on the National Mall. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Targeted advertising is everywhere. Your emails, your web browser, your phone. Data is being collected and used really for one reason, to sell you more stuff. The next frontier in tracking technology is upon us. Facial recognition is what it is. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. Hey, Ben.
Hi, Kai.
Has to be a marketing angle to this thing, right? I mean, companies using it to sell us something?
Absolutely. This is why companies want to start using this technology. And the obvious thing here, right, is location-based marketing. You know that scene in the Minority Report movie when Tom Cruise walks into the mall and the walls start talking to him, hey, you want to buy a new pair of jeans like the ones you bought last time? So connecting a person's past behavior and their data to their current location is kind of a holy grail for companies when it comes to marketing. And our faces are also kind of incredible maps that you can tell personality from, and also maybe how we're feeling. So imagine you go into a store and there's like a camera on the shelf of items that you're looking at, and that camera records the emotional reaction you have to the stuff you're looking at, and companies use that for marketing.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I did a demo of that the last time I was in Manhattan, in point of fact. So yeah, it's a little scary. Which brings me to privacy advocates, who I imagine on this are going bananas.
They are a little bit going bananas. And the sort of difference that is arising here is privacy advocates want this to be opt-in. They want you as the user to say, okay, I accept that you want to use facial recognition on me when I go into a stadium or into a mall or another place like this. But a lot of companies don't really want that, right? They want to start using it as a default.
What's the next step then? I mean, because the technology exists. We're going to use it. Scott McNeely, you have no privacy, the former Sun Microsystems guy.
Yeah.
Where do we go from here?
Well, first of all, we have to think about the fact that, you know, no matter what, technology companies are going to build this stuff and they're going to start using this stuff. They're going to ask for forgiveness, not permission, right?
Right.
And you remember when Google Glass had some facial recognition technology in it, and that got rolled back because people were freaked out about it. So like anything, Kai, in the technology world, this stuff is going to start popping up and start being used. I think something worth thinking about. Now, Facebook did a presentation at a conference this month in which the company showed that it took 40,000 publicly available images and it was able to identify people 83% of the time, even when their face wasn't in the photo.
Wow.
So they were taking things like body language, they were taking things like hairdo, clothing choice, and they were using that information to correctly identify people. So this could be used in crime investigations. Of course, the FBI has its own facial recognition database called the Next Generation Identification that is supposed to have 52 million images in it. So there's some terrorism fighting implications here. But we're going to start to see more and more of it, and it could be used as something like a kind of biometric login for the next time you go to an ATM, for instance, you could use your face.
Which is a whole different kind of hacking. Ben Johnson, the host of Marketplace Tech. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Kai.
So listen, I've got good news and bad news about health, diet, and our collective weight issue in this country. A study just published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Internal Medicine says less than a third of Americans are at a healthy weight. The good news is that we're thinking about our food and what's in it more than ever. Restaurants know it, too, fast food places in particular. They're changing up their menus, they're getting rid of artificial flavors and finding better ingredients. But does all of that make the food, you know, better for you? Jessica Robinson invited a nutritionist to lunch to find out.
I meet Terry Perry, great name, Terry Perry, at Chipotle Mexican Grill in Spokane, Washington. Perry works for a program that helps food stamp recipients make good food choices.
So are you ready to eat?
I'm hungry.
Good.
Perry settles for a salad, and I get the burrito.
I will have black beans.
Outside, we sit next to a big sign announcing that her salad and my burrito are now GMO-free. Perry, meanwhile, is busy counting up the calories in the guacamole-capped salad mountain in front of her.
So before the guacamole came on with the beans, chicken, lettuce, and tomatoes, I would probably estimate it to be around 400 calories. And then the guacamole could possibly be another 400 calories.
Chipotle's online nutrition calculator says actually there are only 230 calories in the guacamole. But even if that's right, this is still about twice the calories of Perry's usual lunch. Even so, she's impressed.
It tastes pretty delicious. I mean, it tastes fresh to me.
Okay, so here's the big question. How much more nutritious does this become because they've removed GMOs from the food?
Well, it doesn't really change the calorie level of the food. It doesn't change the nutrient level, how many vitamins, minerals, protein, carbohydrate, fat is in it.
To cut to the chase, it's not any more nutritious. And the things Perry is worried about, high blood pressure, heart disease, diabetes, the 70% of Americans who are overweight, portion size does matter, like that mound of guacamole. Still, overall, Perry says if you save half for later, she approves of our Chipotle meal. So, not too bad. Next up, the real wilds of American cuisine, the Taco Bell drive-thru.
Hello, take your time, we're going to be ready.
Can we get a nachos bel grande?
Calorie count, 760 calories.
That seems like a good bang for our buck.
That is a good bang for our buck.
We pull out the goods in the shade of a nearby tree.
Well, looks like food.
Yum! Brands recently announced it will remove artificial colors and flavors from food at Taco Bell and Pizza Hut. But Perry seems underwhelmed.
It's not bad. I mean, it's not terrible. It's very salty.
And she says removing the food coloring won't cut down on the sodium or the saturated fat or the extra carbs. There's a lot of science out there saying too much of these three things is bad for you. Not so much the food dye.
Fresh has become the most bankable word in food service. And processed has become a four-letter word.
That's Aaron Allen, a restaurant consultant. He says people are becoming more obsessed with all-natural, organic, and local. And fast food restaurants have noticed.
So they found some quick wins that they can gain in terms of public perception by making some very easy steps, like actually using real pepper instead of an artificial flavor that tastes like pepper.
Part of it is driven by the wild success of Chipotle, the fresh poster child. But their ingredient changes aren't necessarily health-driven either. Genetically engineered foods aren't any less safe, according to the World Health Organization, the National Academies of Science, the American Medical Association, and even Chipotle?
It wasn't a change that was rooted in health or nutrition.
Spokesman Chris Arnold says the change from GMOs was motivated by concerns about environmental impacts. But also, consumers just don't like GMOs. For our nutritionist, Terry Perry, the fight to get people to focus more on fat, salt, carbs, and serving size continues. But there's also the little matter of taste. And even she understands what she's up against as she devours a chip from our nachos bel grande.
And I'm not saying it tastes bad. I mean, I could sit down and eat this whole thing.
And there's still half a Chipotle salad after that. In Spokane, Washington, I'm Jessica Robinson for Marketplace.
We've been doing an Every Now and Then series the past couple of months about first jobs, because almost by definition, everybody's had one, right? Today, a woman who found her first job at the zoo.
My name is Hannah Hayes. My first job was a zoo chef. Once I completed the sort of introductory program of cleaning up animal excrement in all kinds of exhibits, I got to shadow the commissary employees, and they prepare all of the food for the animals. I had these visions of going out on the gators and taking food to the actual animals and watching them enjoy it and feeling satisfaction for that. And then when I got there, it turned out that I was locked in a pretty big industrial kitchen all day. And it was fluorescently lit, and there was a really terrible, crackly transistor radio playing Garth Brooks all the time. And it's not exactly how I envisioned spending my summer vacation. when I would go into the building, there would be whiteboards around the entire room, and I would just start with the recipes on the left side and work my way around. And each animal had a specific diet that it was supposed to be given. I would make fruit salad for parrots. I would create pine cones covered in peanut butter with chocolate chips or whatever the bears wanted to eat. I often would go into the freezer to get out dead baby mice for the snakes. There were lots of creative liberties I could take in terms of ingredients, in terms of what would compose an elephant salad. I kind of had a range of different lettuce varieties I could pick from. And that was definitely my first experience in a industrial commercial kitchen. At first, I was kind of apprehensive and scared about what they were asking me to do. By the end of it, I think I felt pretty empowered about what I could accomplish, and made me feel empowered in the kitchen, essentially, that I could create things.
Hannah Hayes is a magazine food editor right now. Our series comes from a book edited by Merritt Watts. It's called First Jobs. This final note today, in which summertime officially goes all digital and social media on us. Ad Age reports that Good Humor is bringing back its ice cream trucks, which is, I know, awesome, right? Except that instead of that classic jingling of the ice cream truck bells, you're going to have to follow the truck on Twitter to figure out where it's going to be, which just somehow bums me out. I mean, I love Twitter, but it's just not the same, right? The NASDAQ up 6 points today, 10%. The Dow up 24 points, 0.1% as well. The S&P 500 up a point, basically. We'll call that flat. Caitlin Esch and Vanessa Smith are the producers on our Marketplace desks. Our digital producers are Raghu Manavalan and Tony Wagner. The senior digital producer is Nishat Kurwa. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.